Aloha, and welcome back to System Fix, the podcast for health reform junkies from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor, Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, I speak to regular panellists and invited guests about change in the New Zealand health sector, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for joining me. And welcome to episode 26 of System Fix. Joining me today are independent health policy expert Gabrielle Baker, Napui Ngāti Kuri, and Auckland University Professor of Health Policy, Tim Tenbensil. We're recording on 28th of February as the parliamentary debate closes on the Paiora Disestablishment of Māori Health Authority Amendment Bill. And as I raced out of the office to record this episode, another health reform report was released by Health Minister Shane Retty. You'll find all the reports we talk about in this episode in the vault on nzdoctor.co.nz. Thanks for listening. Hey, well, welcome to 2024.
Sure, Barbara.
Ta-da.
You know, another report came out today, Ministerial Advisory Committee health reform implementation. It's quite an in-depth one, and I honestly haven't looked at it at all, but it was established under the original legislation as a committee to report back on the progress with reforms.
I did notice.
So I suspect
that committee was there last week when I was looking through stuff.
It was commissioned in September 2022, and it was dated November 2023, and the minister proactively released it today. Just looking at the press release now that came out from Shane Retty, can't really at a quick glance see any kind of summary of what the reports. Oh, here we go. The report notes significant ongoing pressures for community and primary care, including around access and sustainability, confusion over the role of localities in the new system, an urgent need for agreed public health operating model, risk around Health New Zealand Te Whatu Ora's transformation change being subsumed by operational challenges. It does acknowledge that the positives include the delivery of last year's winter preparedness plan and a more effective way of transferring patients between areas to get access to treatment. But overall, it's clear that turning the health ship around will take years of intensive work, says Dr. Retty. Where do we start? As it's all fresh in our mind, it might be best to start with the reading of the Paiora Disestablishment of Māori Health Authority Amendment Bill. So, Gabrielle, did you listen to much of the actual parliament?
Yeah, I was lucky in a sense that I was able to listen to the whole thing. Lucky in a sense that not the nicest way to spend my time listening to parliamentary debate, but it was good to be able to hear and sort of in real time how they were processing it and how it was being responded to in the House.
I was sitting next to a colleague in the office who was listening to it. He had his headphones on, and every now and then there'd be a shout about a certain aspect of it. But my general feeling was that Dr. Retty came in for some pretty hard questioning from, particularly it turned out he's got more relatives in Parliament than possibly he realised, more close connections. What was your feeling on that aspect of it?
It's interesting because it's been a little while since I've watched a parliamentary debate that intensely and intently. And it's easy to forget that the debates, especially when the government has got the majority in the House so clearly, the debate to me wasn't for Minister Retty or for the national coalition government. It was for the wider public. So lots of the stuff that was being said was to register disapproval, knowing that not much else could be done at that point.
Mm. You're nodding your head there, Tim.
Yes, I'm nodding my head, not having seen the debate, so I will defer to both of you on this one.
And of course, the debate came along with the controversy around its timing with regard to the Y3307 hearing that was planned for 29th of February and the 1st of March. Can you give us an update on that, Gabrielle?
I mean, and certainly that's the most notable thing here. I mean, it was never a surprise that Te Aka Whai Ora was going to be disestablished under this government. They were clear through the election process. They were clear immediately after signing coalition agreements. But the timing has been particularly notable for its potential lack of good faith. So within days of the 100-day plan, the tribunal got its first claim saying there needs to be an urgent inquiry into this. And the tribunal worked really quickly to say, I think it was around the 19th of January, the tribunal said there were grounds for an urgent hearing. And then there was a whole lot of back and forth of papers in a kind of standard way, with the Crown not giving a lot of information about what was going to replace Te Aka Whai Order, which was kind of what was asked of them, so we can make a more informed decision to not have urgency potentially. So not a lot of information coming out from the Crown side. The hearing was set down, heaps of work going on behind the scenes to get evidence ready, to present cases tomorrow and Friday, the 29th and 1st. And then on Friday, the 23rd, you know, after normal business hours, Crown Law came back and said a bill could be introduced on Tuesday. So at that point, the tribunal's jurisdiction, which was already sort of in question around whether they could inquire into something like this around legislation, it becomes incredibly limited. So they weren't really able to have, if it was introduced and before the House, then it goes out of their remit. So the cynical observers were like, well, we did everything we could to have this heard before the end of your 100-day plan. And without kind of telling us what your plans were, you've now had us do all of this work for nothing.
And you can't underestimate how much work must have gone in.
The kind of the grounds for urgency were that Māori hadn't been consulted with the legislation. And the Crown's argument was, well, it was discussed during the election and that's enough of a mandate. And the tribunal was like, well, that's not consultation. And then the fact that it's passed through the House without going to select committee kind of reinforces that, that there's not been an opportunity for Māori to give input into it.
Well, for me, the whole story and sequence of events really brings up, I guess, memories, not that I actually have these memories directly, but memories of the 1980s and 1990s. I wasn't living here at the time, but I know all governments use urgency, particularly at this stage of the electoral cycle. But in a system which, compared to other democratic systems around the world and parliamentary democracies, has very few checks and balances compared to just about any other country you would care to name, the use of urgency is an aspect of the concentration of constitutional power that is almost unjustifiable, or I really wonder about what its role is apart from giving governments the opportunity to say, so there, we can do it because we can.
Mm.
And it goes back to, you know, the old Geoffrey Palmer days of talking about elective dictatorships. It's an extraordinary mechanism which we would not expect to see in a parliamentary democracy, lack of checks and balances.
So the passing of the bill and the work that's gone into these cabinet papers, the briefing papers, has also highlighted that it isn't actually that simple to take Te Aka Whai Order out of the picture. The flow-on effect, its impact on the iwi Māori partnership boards and localities and the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee, just some of the elements, and obviously its impact on the Ministry of Health and on Te Whatu Ora. I'm not even sure where to start with that, although I have to say, we'll probably come back to it, I was surprised and not surprised by the decision to stop work on localities, because obviously localities are connected to the iwi Māori partnership boards, and without Te Aka Whai Order, where iwi Māori partnership boards sit and where they get their resourcing and their funding from is far from clear. And then likewise, the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee. So it's all kind of a domino effect. So perhaps we could start with the impact on the iwi Māori partnership boards. Have you guys had a chance to consider that through the papers we've got here or through listening to Parliament?
I feel like I've had this conversation with the two of you before, but it's just amazing to me that the iwi Māori partnership boards, which were so neglected for so long, continue to find a way to survive through this. So the main thing is they're still there. While exactly what they would do and exactly what the support they will get in the new system is unclear, I think, thank goodness, they've survived all this. The conversation in the House in the last 24 hours, I think if I was being optimistic, I would interpret some of the conversation about seeing them having more of a role in commissioning, which was certainly something that I think some of the iwi Māori partnership boards had imagined was something they'd be working towards anyway.
I took the opportunity the other day to listen to the recording of the first live stream with Te Whatu Ora presenting its annual review to the Health Select Committee. I was actually interested in what it was like for the new Health Select Committee members who didn't necessarily have much grounding in the health sector to listen to Te Whatu Ora talking about what they do. And both with iwi Māori partnership boards and localities, I felt that initially the Select Committee was left with an impression that these bodies were more developed than they actually are. And I think we know, particularly for localities, that there's only a number of prototypes going. But with the iwi Māori partnership boards, we know that iwi involvement with health around the country is variable, let alone setting up a partnership board that is going to be actively involved with provision, commissioning health services.
Well, I think it all means that there's lots of loose ends in the amended bill now. So CPAORA is a structural change that was very intricately tied up with the substantive policy direction of both reducing inequities and giving expression to tutelage in some form. The second of those is definitely off the table, but you can still see plenty of clauses in the CPAORA which give effect to that. And so a new government is going to be operating with a piece of legislation that it doesn't agree with the direction of it, but because it wants to push stuff through in urgency and in 100 days for symbolic reasons and play to the gallery, it's potentially creating quite a messy legislative sort of environment for it to work in and might create problems for itself further down the line by doing that.
Yeah, I just wonder with the because with the iwi Māori partnership boards, the question of who they would answer to, who would manage them or administer them, and I've had a number of conversations over the last 24 hours, so I'm not sure whether this is coming from Parliament or from the briefing papers. But, I mean, if you were going to have a group of agencies representing iwi involved in the health sector, you know, in terms of independence, you wouldn't really want them answering to the Ministry of Health. And that doesn't really sit right with them to be answering to Te Whatuora as the service provider. So surely you would create an agency that would provide oversight or secretariat services or such like. Maybe you would create a Māori Health Authority, perhaps. Mm. The other body which has kind of grown in prominence is the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee through this process. And I was thinking back to when, in the early days of the reforms, we had the committee led by Mason Drury, which was involved with consulting with Māori around the appointment of the members to the interim Māori Health Authority. And then the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee was set up to monitor Te Aka Whai Ora. Is anyone kind of clear on what its current role has been before it actually gets a juicier role?
I'm not entirely clear on how it's being used. I think that's kind of what you're asking. I'm not entirely sure how it's being used. I can talk a little bit about the debate in the House on this, but it was more around the changes around the mechanism for appointing members. So the thing that's changed is under the Pai Order legislation, the members of the Hauora Māori Advisory Committee would eventually, like currently they're all ministerial appointments, they would eventually be appointed from, like they'd be considered more representative or, you know, put forward by iwi Māori partnership boards and other Māori groupings. So for example, the Māori doctors would be part of a grouping of people who could put up possible members. And so this removes all of that, and now they'll only be ministerially appointed. And they also then, they had this potential role. Like, I think the thing is that they always had this potential role to be different. Like, they had the ability to, do you remember that there are dispute resolution mechanisms in the Pai Order Act, and they had a role in that to help guide ministers through when their Te Aka Whai Order and Te Whatu Order weren't agreeing. So
I mean, I was going to comment on the significance of the changing nature of the way committee members will be appointed. And I guess that's a classic move. If you're not really interested in the committee, you can just make sure that all its members are appointed by ministers. And then one possibility, I'm not saying this will happen, but one possibility is that we'll just wither on the vine and not be given, you know, sort of the sustenance and support for it to operate, particularly now that its main role that had been carrying out, recalling the report that it put out in the early days of the development of Te Aka Whai Ora, now that role is gone. So A, not clear what it will be doing, what kind of heft it has or what sort of influence it has. And in those sorts of ambiguous situations, unless you have a minister actively putting energy into it and sort of shaping what its role is, it tends to get forgotten or sidelined or not clear. And yeah, so it may continue to meet for a while and then people end up saying, well, what's the point of doing this?
When we look back to the reforms when they were first proposed, and there was controversy over the set up a Te Akawai or the Māori Health Authority, obviously right back to the Simpson Report days when we had the alternative view, which was supported by the majority of the panel members and by the Māori Advisory Committee to the panel. But of course, that view gave the Te Akawai more independence that it eventually received. So there will be people who, although disappointed at the loss of Te Akawai Ora, might also say that, well, actually, it wasn't really what we were after to start with. And also, there has been comments around where it fits with, for instance, the Whana Ora commissioning agencies, where they've sat through all this process. I have to confess, I'm not really up to date with, you know, what's been happening in the area of the Whana Ora commissioning agencies, but I just wondered if that's something either of you could comment on, because those agencies obviously have relationships with iwi groups in social services and health services already. Would they be placed to take advantage of the loss of Te Akawai Ora, or were maybe they overlooked in the whole process of setting up Te Akawai Ora?
I think if they're taking on their word, the government is interested in having funding decisions made closer to communities. And that was part of the rationale, not all of the rationale, for the establishment of Whana Ora commissioning agencies. So I would say there's probably an opportunity for them and other groups in here. And it's going back a little bit on what you were saying, the Te Akawai Ora was not the form that lots of people were asking for. And there actually is some common ground between what was discussed before it was established and what is being discussed now as it's being disestablished. So one of the things that I heard really clearly when I was talking to people about a Māori health authority as a conceptual thing, it hadn't yet existed, was that it can't be bureaucratic, it can't be Wellington based. And that was pretty much one of the main arguments from the Minister of Health and the House over the last 24 hours. It's bureaucratic, we can't have a Wellington based Māori health authority. Firstly, I don't think it's completely true. It's a bit of a myth that it's completely bureaucratic. And secondly, that is what happens when you make something a statutory entity that's like a crown entity. I know that when people were first starting to work for Te Akawai Ora, almost everyone I know who was doing it, sorry if you're listening and you think that I'm generalizing you, was like, oh, you know, you're not going to be in Wellington that much. And then you start to get interested and you have to spend a lot of time in Wellington.
It's like gravity.
Yeah.
I feel like when we had the reforms, Te Whatu Ora merged all the DHBs, there was always the challenge. You know, they talked all the time about changing the culture, like a new culture, a one system. But we were bringing all these people in, and despite their best intentions, they were all DHB people trying to change. And to me, Te Akawai Ora almost represented a kind of conscience, because it was new and it was very clear about what it was there for, to achieve equity and health outcomes for Māori. And it was, you know, the legislation slotted it in at a whole pile of points in Te Whatu Ora's life and in the public health agency. So I think that whether it was quite what everybody wanted, it was something new and it was bringing a different take on a lot of stuff in a health reform that wasn't so much a health reform as a health restructure, I think, is what Tim may have described it as in the past. Tim?
Oh, gosh, there's quite a few leads there. I mean, there's a number of things I'm thinking along the way. Is I'll take your points, Gabrielle, about the gravitational pull to Wellington and sort of a number of processes. But the whole rhetoric of things being Wellington-based, whether it's Te Akawai Ora or particularly Te Whatu Ora, is just such a nonsense, which I find, you know, it is a central organisation, but it's actually dispersed. It's not in any place. Its headquarters are in South Auckland, Te Whatu Ora. It's just another example of how sound bites and political rhetoric are so far removed from the actual reality. I mean, my other example is not to say that, you know, National's the only party doing this. I mean, I used to get really irritated with the previous government's use of postcode lottery. One, it's never a lottery, it's historical, you know, and B, it's nothing to do with postcodes. But it's a phrase that worked in England, so why don't we adopt it here? So we get the same with the whole thing about bureaucrats in Wellington deciding, and the whole thing about separatism is another example of that, which is just, you know, something that plays to the gallery but has no link to reality that I can see, or that anyone in the health sector can see.
Have you got anything else to add before we move on to localities?
Just one thing of you talking about the culture of Te Whatu'ora and the culture of DHBs, I think the important thing to realise is that the DHBs all had different cultures. So, yes, there are some things that they had in common, but now what you're seeing, I think, in Te Whatu'ora is which of those cultures comes to the top. I think we can probably name a couple of the large Auckland-based DHBs that have come out, or people from those particular DHBs that have come out as particularly influential in the new system. And that's something to watch, because those cultures are really important in terms of how Te Whatu'ora and non-government organisations relate to each other, whether they're, you know, that includes Māori and Pacific providers, includes, you know, private businesses or whatever. And, you know, we know that some DHBs were much more antagonistic and often for good reason, and others were much more collaborative. And, you know, so we're starting to see all that shape the broader culture of Te Whatu'ora.
I just wanted to add just a little bit before we move on, just to the myth-making things that are happening here. Like, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny, really. The point that was often made in the House, that Te Aka Whaiora hasn't achieved enough and that that's part of the rationale for not needing them, it really sets this quite extraordinary timeframe that you need to be able to prove your value in. 18 months, you needed to have proved a whole lot of stuff. And I think we all know that even if they'd proved everything ever, this is not about how well the staff or the organisation or the board had done. It was a decision completely outside of that. But that doesn't stop it being used as a rationale.
Yes, I think it's unfortunate that Te Whatu'ora and Te Aka Whaiora are often put in the same sentence when it talks about how much progress there's been with health reforms, because they were completely different. One was a brand new organisation and the other was emerging and an active, you know, still providing services all the way through the merger. So, localities. So localities have been an interesting issue from day one. I think we can all agree, when they came onto the scene, there was a lot of optimism because people heard what the transition unit was saying about local groups being able to get together and make decisions about what was happening locally and maybe be involved with locality commissioning and drawing up locality plans. And as time has gone on, they've discovered that actually no, there is no locality commissioning that will be done by Te Whatu'ora. The plan will be created in agreement with Te Whatu'ora. There is no extra money for localities aside from the money that's been given to the prototypes. And of course, when we finally got the legislation, we basically, locality was a geographical area. So, but in the meantime, a lot of groups have kind of just run with it and put a heck of a lot of work into developing their localities. And particularly here in Auckland, we have the South Seas Group, which has drawn together a large number of community groups and healthcare providers, despite the indicators from Te Whatu'ora that maybe they're moving a bit too fast. But now we know for sure that localities has been put on hold. And in legislation, in fact, we're talking about 2030 as the timeframe for creation of localities.
If plans have to be done.
The Simpson Report started from a promise for a primary care funding review. When we finally got the Paiora legislation, the localities, which was the primary care part of it, was the last cab out of the rank. And it was always a fear there wouldn't be enough enthusiasm, energy or money left by the time we got to that point. And it's all come to fruition.
Yeah, and I do think that part of this was the image of localities in the legislation, even though it was pared down from what had been imagined by many before, it still, to me, had a bit of a status of a unicorn in that there were so many parameters that were needed to be taken into account, and they were all important in their own right. But when you put them all together, that is the reason why it's taken them so long to get off the ground, because the degree of consultation involved in getting one up and running is pretty substantial. So this is not to say that all the ideas that sort of informed those decisions weren't valid ideas, but as a practical mechanism, it was never going to be something that was going to happen quickly.
No.
But the other side of this is, okay, the minister has clearly indicated in cabinet papers and press release yesterday that, you know, services closer to home is something in community input into the design of services and, you know, all the same buzzwords that any government uses, they're all still there. So how's he, you know, what's going to sort of fill in that picture now? Where's that advice going to come from? And it's going to come from either the ministry or Te Whatu Ora, and I would suspect more Te Whatu Ora, or external consultants. No, I don't think so at the moment. Or where? So, you know, the ideas will still be kicking around. Many of them will be kicking around, maybe with a few less constraints around them, so that there might be something that emerges out of this that looks like localities, maybe a more streamlined version of them. Or maybe not. Maybe nothing will happen for years.
Because it's pretty crucial, like for Māori and Pacifica communities, these localities were a real opportunity to build on what they had achieved through the COVID pandemic response, like that involvement with communities. Now they're kind of left high and dry.
I guess I'm too cynical and I don't really buy the stuff that was in the cabinet paper about the reason we're doing this is really because of Te Aka Whai Ora, and if we take that out, we need to figure out what replaces it, so give us more time. Especially when you mentioned the material that was released today by the minister that looks like it's talking about the lack of clarity around localities, which I think that's more persuasive to me, actually, that there has been a bit of a lack of clarity around it because it becomes a bit of a too hard issue. From what I've seen of them, and it has been through the lens of how iwi Māori partnership boards might be experiencing the localities, it's a mixed bag again, isn't it? So some of them you could see having found ways to use that mechanism to build relationships that were meaningful, but I still couldn't quite tell what was going to happen with them. So strong relationships were one thing, but what will be different for people experiencing locality services?
That always seemed to be so far in the distant future, those sorts of questions. And one of the things I think was already happening, it would have happened without a change of government, is the sort of the loss of faith from many of the organisations and communities that were involved in the process, and which makes it much harder to get them back next time round. I think, you know, at least for a few years until people have either forgotten or people are, you know, sort of doing those things. So, you know, it's been a window of opportunity that is closed, and we didn't see anything come through it. I mean, look, of the prototypes, there still might be some good results to come out of that, but it has long-term implications, I think. And what there is now is essentially a vacuum where, you know, who's going to take the initiative now? Is there going to be any forward momentum on this at all? And, you know, one scenario here is that we could see much quicker action on primary healthcare funding, but now it may be driven more as a sort of medical-based primary care model rather than the sort of the broader one that was envisaged in localities.
It is possible that some of the primary health organisations will obviously step into the space, and to give them credit, they have been working on improving, you know, their interactions with with community groups and the multidisciplinary approach. So if we kind of step back and think what's happened in the last couple of weeks, what does it all mean for the patient?
Always depends which patient.
Exactly. So we can probably assume that Māori patients are going to be impacted by the loss of Te Aka Whai Ora. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think what you lose is some of the checks and balances in the system such that it was. And I think there are some immediate kind of impacts about what it says about the value of Māori within the system. I think there's a kind of a trust and confidence in the system thing that happens immediately with this for Māori that I think causes harms immediately. But the longer term question, I think, is Tim's answer was the only one I could give. We know some people it won't have any impact on, and there'll be people who are already not doing well under the current system, who will continue to have to wait for system improvement to reach them.
Yeah, I think the immediate impact is more democratic processes and also deteriorating relationships. It's not a health impact in the short term. We can't compare it to a long-term process that hasn't happened. But I would say there's lots of momentum, I guess, in the commissioning space and the staff of Te Aka Whai Ora coming into Te Whatu Ora. And in terms of thinking about how contracts, you know, they're going to be changes to contract or, you know, probably rolling over existing contracts because they can't do everything at once. But, you know, moving towards a more longer term commissioning model that is more about relationship building. We've been making small steps in that direction for a while now, and it's very patchy and partial across the country, but that momentum will continue. So it's more the process stuff that I think it will be the immediate effect of it, you know, and the sort of the effects on trust. I'm not sure many people outside the health sector are aware of just how much support, at least in public statements, that Taka Whaiora has had from across the health system.
Yeah.
And, you know, there hasn't been any of the arguments about sort of the supposed disadvantages to Taka Whaiora that have been actually put by people in the health system.
That must be a reflection of working in the health system, observing the health system. We've known for years what the shortcomings are, and everyone was looking for new ways of doing things to address that issue of achieving equity in health outcomes. Reflecting on the idea that the health services still represent 20% of our health and well-being, and I kind of feel at the moment, you know, we've got smoke-free changes coming through. We've had the sudden change of te reo in the names of organisations, and then the issues around the benefits and greater scrutiny of, you know, what people are getting and whether they deserve it or not. And it's kind of like outside of the health services, there's lots of things that are building up to impact on people's well-being and inevitably will affect the most vulnerable. Just in terms of the sector having its own 100-day plan, you know, where does it go from here? Like with localities, you've both kind of alluded to the fact that it's a bit of a limbo, but the health sector carries on. And if you had your own 100-day plan, what would you be looking for to happen in the next 100 days?
Like, I honestly don't even know where to begin because I don't see things in 100-day cycles, so I find it a hard.
That's true.
Like the kind of thing that I'm thinking about that we need is much more fundamental than what the health system can do because of what you're saying. The same population groups that are most impacted from the stuff around justice, the stuff around, you know, the gang stuff that was talked about, like all of this that was been on the media today and then over the weekend, all of this is impacting the same population over and over again. So I think that it's limited what the health system can do by itself. If I was to think within the health system only, exclusively, I would think about the stuff that the Waitangi Tribunal talked about in addition to Te Aka Whaiora. So Te Aka Whaiora or an independent Māori health authority was one element of what they thought could improve the health system. But one of the other ones that was just as prominent was reviewing primary healthcare funding and making that so that it was set up to achieve equity from the outset, not what it has become over time more and more about inequitable funding. So why don't we start there if you can't do Te Aka Whaiora?
That's a good point. Tim?
You took the words out of my mouth, Gabrielle. I keep coming back to it. What's most urgent at the moment is something to happen in the space of primary care funding. Actually, it still will take a while to design. So, you know, 100-day cycle, sorry, I'm not buying into the whole, you know, playbook of American electoral politics that has kind of seeped into our tradition here. Speed is often the enemy of good policy anyway. But, you know, certainly something around the review of the capitation formula or something that would pick up on the incredible amount of good information that has been made available in the last couple of years. But it's quite a technical thing to sort of work through the scenarios and sort of to design the instrument so it's not going to have, you know, unintended consequences or, you know, inequitable results.
Well, I feel like we've only really touched on a small part of what's happened so far. We've had the release of the health status report, which seems to be a crucial document under the Whaiora legislation. It's involved with the health plan, how we make decisions about what's in the health plan. And also we're still waiting on the government policy statement on health that's yet to come out. We have submissions being called on legislation as Whaiora Mental Health.
It's about the role of the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission being subsumed somewhere in the Whaiora Act, which it hadn't been previously.
Okay, so I wasn't sure about that one. And then smoke-free legislation changes. Gabrielle, you've been involved with the claim for people with disabilities that we haven't covered for quite some time. Where actually is that at now?
Oh, that's at a critical phase. So the all of the evidence from claimants has been heard, and on the 18th of March, the first Crown evidence starts to be heard. We're still a while away from it being finished, but this is the beginning of the Crown evidence and response.
Is there anything else in the 100-day plan that's going to kind of come out to haunt us anytime soon?
Barbara, I just wanted to sort of put in a plug for the health status report, which a first of its kind document will be a very useful resource, if it's nothing else, for teaching. But I think what really struck, two things struck me about that health status report. One was the alarming figures around youth mental health and distress. And secondly, there's all sorts of stuff about, you know, using the deprivation index to sort of track things. And one thing that's becoming really clear is, I think the shape of deprivation or the shape of inequality, it used to be, we talk about debt five in health sector, you know, the sort of the basically the poorest 20% or people, the least income. I think that is expanding. That group is expanding. The group that is in serious disadvantage is now, I think, hitting the next deprivation quintile. So no longer talking about the 20%, it's the 30 or 40%, which I think is coming through a lot of the health statistics.
Mm.
So I think we really need to have a conversation about that. It's not really about health system, but it's still really important. And the other stuff in the 100-day plan, just flicking through here, what I've got. You don't want to hear me about health targets again, so I won't. breast cancer screening workforce to do it. That will be the big issue.
Mm.
Yeah, not saying it's a reason not to do it, but it's going to be the big issue in implementing it. So
I actually got in touch with the ministry after that came out, because in Minister Retty's media release, I mean, he'd had a function, I think, in South Auckland to make the announcement, and there were no dates given. Given the workforce issue, I was interested to know if they had any expectations. And I think they came back with 3 to 5 years, but it would be obviously a stepped rollout. It was suggested to me that it was maybe in search of a good news story rather than something that is actually going to impact on people's health anytime soon. And maybe that's what you need when you're passing legislation that's reversing smoke-free initiatives. Some good news somewhere else.
I mean, the only thing I wanted to add and to make really clear, like, I'm really feeling for the people directly affected by the Te Akawhai order changes. And I think it was really clear in the House that the individuals who are in leadership positions were all, you know, talked about really positively and all of those things. But just to acknowledge that, I reckon it's a bit rough.
Absolutely. Like you said, such a short time. And I know the kind of energy that's gone into building something new. And as, you know, Tim said, you know, inside the health sector, this was really welcomed. So in so many ways, we are losing something before we really know how much benefit it was going to give us. It's been lovely talking to you today. Hopefully we'll get to talk again sooner rather than later, because I think it's going to be a busy year. And I appreciate you're both really busy as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you guys. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you would like to keep up to date with issues in primary care and the wider health sector, subscribe to New Zealand Doctor Rite Aotearoa at nzdoctor.co.nz. Or to keep up with issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications offer group subscriptions and discounted subscriptions for health professionals. And don't forget to subscribe to System Fix wherever you usually download your podcasts. Thank you to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix. This is Barbara Fountain signing off. Until next time, thanks for listening. Nga mihi nui.